Linda Moulton Howe, our special guest tonight, as she is every month, our investigative reporter. And, of course, we'll talk about some near-death experience stories when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. Linda is with us. Linda, let's get into this story, too, and tell me how you went about these near-death experience stories.
Well, I've always been interested in what happens at the moment of death. Ever since maybe decades ago, I read an article about how a man had tried an experiment with measuring a body before death and then after death, and came up with a particular weight that he assigned to the weight of the soul that had left the body. And 13 years ago, in December 2001, the prestigious Lancet Medical Journal published results from a 10-year study that was entitled, quote, Near-Death Experience in Survivors of Cardiac Arrest, close quote. The lead investigator was Dutch cardiologist Dr. Pim van Lommel, who studied 344 patients that were clinically dead after serious heart attacks. And I interviewed him after this report, and he told me that during their deaths, it was interesting, and they don't know the answer to why, only 18% of that 344 reported seeing a tunnel with a bright light at the end. They encountered beings of light and relatives who had died, and in some cases, they were given a life review about what they had done right and what they had done wrong in life on Earth. Now, Dr. van Lommel wrote in his Lancet article, quote, our results show that medical factors cannot account for the occurrence of NDE, which is near-death experience. All patients had been clinically dead and most did not have NDE. Furthermore, seriousness of the crisis was not related to occurrence or depth of the NDE experience. If purely physiological factors resulting from cerebral anoxia caused NDE, most of our patients should have had this experience. Patients' medication was also unrelated to frequency of NDE, close quote. Well, now, at the end of 2014, comes a book that emphasizes a distinction between near-death experiences and memories by people who are clinically dead without brainwave or heartbeat, but who still describe details of surgery and other experiences during their time of clinical death. The author is Judy Bachrach, who is a longtime contributing editor for Vanity Fair magazine. Her new book is entitled Glimpsing Heaven, The Stories and Science of Life After Death, and it was published this fall of 2014 by National Geographic. Judy told me that it is the scientific mystery of consciousness during clinical brain and body death that intrigued National Geographic editors, and that is what provoked her to talk with doctors, nurses, and patients about what Judy calls death travelers, not near-death experiencers. Here now from Washington, D.C., is author Judy Bachrach.
Near-death experiences can cover a multitude of issues. You can have diabetes and perhaps be near-death. You can have cancer and be near death or not, and you might have experiences. You can hallucinate, you can have low oxygen. All these things are explicable in that instance, in near death. But death travels, which is what I call them, are elements that we have not really explored, and yet we now know, thanks to CPR, that people die, are then resuscitated, and many of them come back with memories of what I call death travels, because they actually travel in their minds, and their minds do not cease thinking with death. And by death, I mean just what doctors mean when they talk about death. It's clinical. You stop breathing. There's no brainstem activity, and your heart stops, and there's no response to pain. That's death. And these people in my book, in Glimpsing Heaven, all fit that category. They were dead. They had experiences. They were not near death. They were dead.
If we're talking about clinical death, then is the only possibility for consciousness in telling vivid details coming from the soul itself?
I don't use the word soul because in Glimpsing Heaven, I try to stay away from religious verbiage, not because I'm a disbeliever or even a believer. It's simply because I don't want to confuse the issue and I'm not a theologian. I'm talking strictly in scientific terms. Clearly, the mind, wherever that may be located, and it now seems that the brain is not the only locus of the mind, keeps on going. Consciousness endures after death. This was a shock to me, I have to say, because I'd never believed that until I started talking to scientists and doctors about it, and nurses, but I'm now forced to believe it.
Of all the people that you've interviewed in this category of death travelers, which is the one that has impacted you the most, convincing you that there is consciousness after the moment of death?
It is the story of Pamela Reynolds Lowry, who was an Atlanta songwriter and singer, a very beautiful woman physically. She looked a lot like Farrah Fawcett, the actress, and highly intelligent. She found that her fingers were growing numb and she was walking unsteadily, and she got horrible, horrible migraines. And they found at the base of her skull a huge aneurysm, which meant she had to have brain surgery or she would die. And so she got involved with a really avant-garde pioneering institute in Arizona, which had developed something called the standstill operation, meaning they put you to death for about an hour. It's a temporary death, but it's a death. The blood is taken from your entire body by a heart-lung machine. You don't breathe by yourself at all. There's no brainstem activity. They tape your eyes shut. They fill you with anesthetics. And there are clickers in your ears to make sure there's no brainstem activity. So when Pamela Reynolds Lowry was wheeled into the operating room, she had no vision. She couldn't hear. She had no blood. She had no anything. She was dead. And they opened up her brain to cut off the aneurysm and make sure it didn't explode in her head. When she came 2 hours later, she was full of grievances, as she told her doctors, and I interviewed one of those surgeons. In the first place, she said she had no understanding why they were poking around her femoral artery, which is in the thigh, when they were supposed to be operating on her brain. And as it turned out, they were poking at her femoral artery because they needed to connect it to the heart-lung machine. She saw all the tools that they used, all the instruments, and she knew that one was supposed to be a saw, but that saw looked exactly like an electric toothbrush, and that was the case. She heard their conversations, which she reported, and finally she said she was really angry at the doctor's insensitivity, because they've been playing the song Hotel California by the Eagles, which is about death and heaven and hell. And she thought that if they were going to do that kind of very risky operation on a person who might die permanently from it, they shouldn't have been playing that. She said she had popped out of her head and had seen the entire operation, which she then described to perfection. When you ask me, what convinced you that these stories were absolutely accurate, that there is consciousness after death? Pamela Reynolds Lowry, one of the first stories I heard when I started my research, convinced me, because there's no way she could have known all those things. She was dead unless there is consciousness after death.
When you interviewed the doctors that would talk to you, what was their reaction to this kind of detail?
No one could believe it, but when they talked to Pamela Reynolds Lowry, they had to believe it. Everything she said was absolutely accurate. Now, you can argue, oh, gee, maybe the anesthetics didn't work. Maybe she was peeking through her taped eyelids. But that's not possible. She had, her surgeon told me, a boatload of anesthetics in her. There was no blood left in her body. She wasn't breathing. She wasn't thinking. They could measure that. They could measure small brain activity through the clickers in her ears. She was dead. There is no way we can explain this except to say there's consciousness after death.
And don't you think that reinforces the concept of mind, body, and soul, the soul perhaps being the animus of the matter body and the seed of consciousness perhaps more important than the brain?
Well, that is what the ancient Greeks believed and what some of their great philosophers believed and what Plato believed. I've interviewed about 100 of them who were dead and come back with memories, as well as the nurses and doctors and scientists who have studied them. So I'm not going to call it a soul, not because I don't believe there's a soul. There probably is one, frankly. But I'm just going to tell you what they say happened. And what they say happened time and time again is that they have distinct, clear memories of experiences after death. And some of those experiences, which is why I call them death travelers, involve meeting other individuals. Sometimes they know those individuals. Pamela Reynolds Lowry met a beloved grandmother who had died. She said, after she popped out of her head, that she met not only a beloved grandmother who had died, but also a beloved uncle who had died at a very young age, and that she felt very strongly that she was, and these are her words, in God's light while she was there. However, both her dead grandmother and her dead beloved uncle wanted her to go back to life, back to her body, and she was very resistant. This is extremely common among the dead. They're very happy wherever they are, and they don't want to go back to their families. And when reminded that she had very young children, which she did at the time, three very young children, she said, you know, I think the kids are going to be fine without me. And to a man and a woman, and I interviewed a lot of people who felt that way, they don't want to go back to life, and they feel that their little children or their spouses or their relations will be perfectly content without them. She was forced to go back into her body. She said she was pushed by her uncle back into her body and that her heart had to be restarted twice before she consented to be among the living. And in fact, her heart, as her surgeon told me, was restarted twice.
Does she have a clear insight about why the uncle was so insistent that she come back to this life?
She, like a number of other people, have no insight. They have to come back kicking and screaming in many instances. They just know, and this is a very common issue among the dead who return, that they're forced to come back. They're told one way or another, usually not with words, that it's not their time. Some things are preordained, apparently, and one of those things could be death.
Why would the doctors who worked on her or anybody else be almost hostile to the idea of consciousness after death?
Well, interestingly, one of the doctors whom I interview at great length in the book, who worked on Pam Reynolds, is not hostile at all to the idea of consciousness after death. But classical science certainly is. Not only is classical science hostile, they indicate if you ask certain scientists about this, they look like, boy, have I ended up with a nut, and they want to change their seats. But the more people I talk about this issue with, the more I found certain scientists and certain doctors not only receptive to the idea, but believing in the idea that there's consciousness after death. And one of them, believe it or not, was my own internist. She said, I'm so glad you're doing that book. She said, it needs to be done. It's very interesting how many people, including scientists and doctors, do believe in consciousness after death, but don't want to discuss it unless you bring it up, because they know how their fellow scientists and doctors will view them after that.
And yet it is probably the bigger truth of life.
And yet it is probably the bigger truth of life. maybe the biggest.
Well, George, that now is her perspective and her research on the extraordinary case of Pamela Reynolds Lowry and so many others in her book. But also, it made me, it provoked me to go back and read a little bit out of Plato. He was the Greek philosopher back in 429 to 347 BC, and he saw the mind as identical with the soul. And Plato argued that the soul both pre-existed and survived the body, going through a continual process of reincarnation or transmigration, was another word. And this is the recycling of souls in and out of body containers from birth and death repeatedly. Well, in my third book, Glimpses of Other Realities, High Strangeness, there are comments by an intelligence agent who worked for MJ-12, the highly classified group since the Truman administration in 1947, that has had the job to keep the public and the media from knowing that extraterrestrial biological entities, the phrase in their own documents, are interacting with Earth. And he told me that the, what they call EBENS, an acronym, said that reincarnation, the recycling of souls, is the machinery of this universe. And further, that the ETs themselves, or at least a few of them, or some of them, are studying the impacts of various body containers on the growth and evolution of souls, and use this most fascinating metaphor. He said, think of a can that you are using to paint a house, and you have different colors for different rooms, and you're using the same can, and you put in the white, and then you let it dry, you put in more paint, and you keep doing this until you have several colors that have built up in the wall of the can, but you only see the last color. That's all you see when you look in the can. But all those other colors are there. And he said, we don't fully understand, but the ETs that they have had some communication with say that there is something extremely vital about the human process here, and that the length of time that certain souls stay or go in to one human body container and out and then back in and out and back in is something that they are studying and monitoring, and that there is something extremely important about the life cycles on this planet, what happens to the souls that are in the containers, and the evolution and growth after the moment of death, which might relate to the whole question of consciousness not being in the brain, but consciousness being literally in the soul, which humanity perhaps still does not fully understand. That it is the seat of consciousness, that it is the seat of consciousness that is described in religious literature as being eternal.
Linda, when we come back, you've got another near-death experience story, and I believe you talk with neurosurgeon Eben Alexander?
That's right, and here is a neurosurgeon who has his own incredible experience and has written another book called Map of Heaven.
Okay, we'll talk. I can't wait to get into that. That's next on Coast to Coast AM. Well, tis the season to be jolly, and that's why we have the Holiday Magic Coast Style CD for you, where proceeds go to veterans' charities to help them out, of course. And so many of us donated our time and our voices to make this CD happen. And we had a great time doing it. Pat Boone is on it, Billy Gibbons from ZZ Top, Lionel Fanthorpe, UFO Phil. You'll hear about Lionel, of course, on Christmas Eve with his annual rendition of 'Twas the Night Before Christmas. We just had a great time doing it. You can go to our website, coasttocoastam.com, look at the CD cover, which is at the highlight reel. You just kind of flash over that and then Click more, and it takes you to Amazon.com, and you can order it. Might be a little late for Christmas now, but what the heck? You can still get the CD and have some fun listening to it through the season. Welcome back to Coast, back with Linda Moulton Howe as she continues her story on near-death experiences and, of course, talking to neurosurgeon Eben Alexander. He's an incredible, incredible kind person to have gone through this, to have written about it. And, Linda, he now has another workout.
That's right. He was born 60 years ago, but he was an adopted baby. He never really knew his family or anyone until after this dramatic event. The family that adopted him and named him encouraged his passions that he had for learning and eventually for skydiving in college. Eben graduated from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill in 1976 with a major in chemistry. And then 4 years later, in 1980, he graduated with an MD degree from Duke University Medical School. After that, he continued with a fellowship in cerebrovascular neurosurgery in the United Kingdom's Newcastle upon Tyne in northern England. After that, for the next 15 years, Dr. Alexander specialized in neurosurgery at Harvard Medical School as an associate professor of surgery and also worked at Brigham and Women's Hospital. Married with children, the Alexanders decided to move from the urban stresses of Boston to the more comfortable environment of Lynchburg, Virginia. And there, Dr. Alexander was hired in the Focused Ultrasound Surgery Foundation of nearby Charlottesville. In the early morning of November 10, 2008, Eben Alexander woke up in such head pain and body paralysis that his wife called 911. For the next 7 days, Dr. Alexander was in Lynchburg General Hospital, baffling his colleague doctors and headed toward death. Eventually, it was discovered that E. coli bacteria was eating away at the base of his brain and the neocortex that surrounds the human brain, which is involved in higher functions such as sensory perception, muscle control, spatial reasoning, conscious thought, and language. When the neocortex is seriously damaged, patients rarely recover. And if they do, their speech and brain functions do not function well. While his doctors and family prepared for his passing, Dr. Alexander went on a spectacular journey to what he called the core of what he calls also the proof of heaven. His guide was a beautiful, angelic-looking girl. They started on the wing of a butterfly and joined thousands of other butterflies heading toward a place of what he called infinite darkness and infinite brightness, where he came to understand his soul had eternal life and consciousness beyond his body container. On the eighth day, when he was expected to die in the Lynchburg General Hospital and all of his family and the doctors were surrounding, waiting for his passing, he suddenly opened his eyes, looked at his family and doctors with curiosity and awareness. 4 months later, he had written more than 20,000 words about his journey on the butterfly with the angelic being to the core of all there is. And 4 years later, in October 2012, his first book, Proof of Heaven, was released and jumped high in the New York Times bestseller book list. And now, at the end of 2014, he has produced a second book called The Map of Heaven. He says that after his first book, Proof of Heaven, he met and heard from thousands of individuals who had their own profound spiritual experiences in near death. He also studied what the world's various religions and philosophers have to say about the soul's survival after death. And here now from Lynchburg, Virginia, is neurosurgeon and author Dr. Eben Alexander.
I would say that the map of heaven is really how we can best visualize about the nature of heaven, how it's a very real place, much more real than this material realm. It's the dwelling place of our souls, and yet it is something that is behind the veil. Once you realize that the brain does not create consciousness, And that is not along the lines of pure scientific materialism or physicalism that I used to worship before my coma. In fact, that's an absolute dead end. That physicalism is the form of conventional science that denies the reality of consciousness, soul, spirit, and especially the divine at the core of it all. In my reading of near-death experiences and all, the light is packaged with that pure, unconditional love that in its purest natural divine form is shattering. It absolutely blows one away. It changes you forever. And that's why the vast majority of those who've had such experiences have no fear of death at all. They realize there is nothing to fear. It's not an end. It's a reconnecting to a much grander and more beautiful, ultra-real existence. But there's a reason why that veil is there.
This is Soul School, and we're here to learn the lesson. And we're only going to be allowed to know what that other side, that spiritual dimension, wants us to know.
Well, there has always seemed this great paradox that if the core of the divine field is unconditional love and the intense light, why in the matter worlds is there so much death and evil?
Well, I would say it's apparent evil. It was clear to me on my journey that this is not a battle between good and evil to see who in the world's going to win. In fact, I came to see it very clearly that light and love and that infinite healing power of that unconditional love are the positive force, and that what we perceive as darkness and apparent evil is the absence of that light and love. For me, another important element of this, and especially along the lines of your question, as I came back, I had seen that reincarnation is crucial to any understanding of any of this. We have multiple incarnations as soul groups here learning and teaching each other lessons through multiple incarnations towards that oneness with the divine. And that whole concept of the importance of reincarnation was driven into me, especially in my efforts to reconcile the infinite loving and knowing and power of that deity in that core was so shocking, and the omniscience and omnipotence that especially in the setting of the suffering of innocents, like children and animals, children killed in warfare, through absolutely no fault of their own, how in the world could that loving and infinitely powerful God allow those things to happen? And when one realizes that reincarnation is part of the fabric of this underlying reality, Soul School, and of this journey that we're all on together, then it made much more sense.
Why do you think, then, in, let's say, the Catholic tradition or Christianity, that reincarnation was essentially erased?
Well, I think it's quite clear that in the Bible, the New Testament talks about John the Baptist, the reincarnation of Ezekiel, the prophet. But I must say that my view of Christianity has been reshaped after my coma experience, because for one thing, I was trying to make sense of everything I learned with my belief systems. And I got into the readings of Elaine Pagels, especially her book on the Gnostic Gospels and her book entitled Beyond Belief, The Secret Gospel of Thomas. And she goes into a lot of 2nd, 3rd century AD and the Council of Nicaea. The story, even in the book of John, is really one of a light body reincarnation. That is, that Christ came back as this very advanced non-physical body, which I think is crucial to getting the difference and the distinction. And a lot of it has to do with understanding how resurrection and reincarnation fit into that early Christian view. And reading those other sources, especially the Gnostic Gospels, helped me to see that reincarnation is a part of the original Christianity, but it was not part of what was included several centuries later when they were threatened with extinction of Christianity. And that's where they made a decision to portray it in a different fashion from what I think is part of the original Christianity.
If reincarnation is the machinery of the universe, the recycling of souls, why do you think that as we are now moving forward in the 21st century, that the planet seems almost blinded to the soul spirit in comparison to the emphasis on the body, the surface of materialism?
That thinking is going extinct because it offers nothing at all to
offer how physical brain might create consciousness. Nobody has the remotest clue.
Why do you think it was your sister that you never knew that you had who would end up taking you on a journey into this profound revelation about heaven?
In spite of the fact that I had a 1 in a billion recovery from that, because by 8 weeks out, my brain had fully recovered and everything was back. If I had seen my father, I would have been a little more tempted to default to my old way of thinking and said, well, the dying brain shows you who you want to see on the way out, and that's the end of that. I knew I'd never met her in my life before. I described her in great detail to family and friends when I first came out of coma, and we were all just mystified. Because the more I got into the near-death literature, the more I realized it's such a guardian angel appearing in a near-death experience of such importance. And there she was, reassuring me with that unconditional love. So it was very haunting that I'd never met her, and yet I could visually remember her perfectly. That's why it was so shocking when I got that picture 4 months after my coma. And there she was. There was that beautiful girl on the butterfly wing. And it just so happened that it was also this birth sister who I didn't even know existed until 2 years after she had left the physical plane. She died in 1998. And I heard about her in the year 2000.
And doesn't it seem like it is pointing to the soul itself, the animus of the container, that it is the soul spirit that had the experience and the knowledge and was able somehow to translate that through you, but it wasn't a brain experience?
Right, exactly. And that, I think, is the key, that it clearly proves that conscious awareness is not created by the physical brain at all. But in fact, is something far grander than our conscious waking state in these human bodies. But that is only the tiniest sliver of our deeper, more profound consciousness that we all reunite with at the time of physical death. We reunite with higher soul and with soulmates and with the divine. But we can also come to access that through deep meditation. But the crucial part, and the part that is taking the scientific world by storm, is that consciousness, soul and spirit are fundamental in this universe.
The Christian Bible has a start of those words, "In the beginning was the Word." Do you think that the Word is the Om sound, and how would it be produced?
I would say yes, that the Word is Om. As I reported in Proof of Heaven, you know, when I came back from that journey, I was still under such extreme shock and awe about the pure, infinite bliss, joy, love, compassion, and forgiveness of that creative deity, that I called that infinite presence Om. That was the sound that I heard in that deepest level. And I basically, to me, when people would ask about that early on, I'd say, well, clearly it seems to be the resonance that one gets when you're in a state of eternity and infinity. And I had seen all the higher dimensional collapse of the multiverse and was there in that infinite eternal realm of the core, and Om was the very natural sound of that creative source of it all.
You would think that humanity would cherish life, and as we move into the 21st century, if we had been learning anything, it seems that we would not be destroying so much Earth life at this particular century. Why do you think humans do not seem to cherish life now?
I think this world is about to wake up more than we ever have in recorded human history. And it has to do with this reconciliation of science and spirituality, or science and religion, in a way that is very deep and fundamental. And I explain all this in The Map of Heaven. We're now at a juncture where we're actually making the choice between planetary suicide or not. And I believe that we have pretty much painted ourselves into this corner. Let's say circumstances or divine plan or whatever have you have put us in this position where we now have to either wake up or proceed inexorably towards planetary suicide, which I do not believe is the correct choice. Ordinary people provide tremendous power in this awakening because their stories out there literally by the hundreds of millions.
Right.
Help to raise this world up to this awakening. We can no longer be in the dark. And by sharing these spiritually transformative journeys, whether it be near-death experiences or shared death experiences, after-death communication, past life memories in children, whatever the vehicles, they are there by the millions. And by taking the lid off and letting every soul share their story, that is what will raise this world up to this whole new level of awakening.
And
he's great.
Those are powerful words to live by in this century. And I would like to say to our Coast listening audience and the Earth Files audience that if you are out there and have had either in the category of the what Judy Bachrach would call the clinical dead and a restoration of life with detailed memories, or in the near-death experience category, I would appreciate hearing from you. And my website is www.earthfiles.com. All of these reports are in-depth with many images and illustrations tonight. And my email address is earthfiles@earthfiles.com. I'll repeat again, earthfiles@earthfiles.com. Think of a reporter who files news about the Earth. And I would like to close, as we go into Christmas and into the new year, on a personal note that I have constantly been reminded of in my interviews with Dr. Alexander, with Judy Bachrach, and with others concerning what happens at the moment of death and beyond. And when I was 21 years old, I was in a very rural and rugged area of Idaho with my brother and a cousin. And we were there on a vacation, and I was climbing a mountain every day. And at one point, I saw light coming down through the trees. And the light was very beautiful and orange and scintillating. It was as if I had never seen light before. And something extraordinary happened that I don't fully understand. I wrote about this in my first and second book, Glimpses of Other Realities. Mm-hmm. And when I got to the bottom of the mountain, I was on a path where all of a sudden a flower in June, it was the month of June, was pulsing an orchid white light. And as I looked at the flower pulsing, it was no longer like a petal. I wanted to have everything go back to normal. And I began to run, not out of fear, but just wanting everything to go back to normal. And when I stopped, it was as if the universe said, you can't run from this lesson. And all of the flowers, as far as I could see, were pulsing this orchid white light. Above me, there were the first stars because the sun had set behind the high mountain, and they were pulsing with the same light as the flowers. And in the mountain above me that I had come down, it seemed to be breathing and looked exactly like the energy sort of rivulets that Van Gogh had in his end of life paintings, as if energy were being shown to me actually inside of the mountain. And then I felt a pressure lift my arms and my hands up in front of me. I didn't do it. It was something in the universe. And as I'm looking at my hands, this thought voice very clearly in my head said, you are one with the light. The light is one with you, and you are in the hands of God forever.
Very powerful, Linda. Back with questions next.